the Attorney General's office, which had followed the case closely, heralded the verdict as a great victory. It was the Ottawa Daily Times that claimed to break the news to Catherine Donahue. As the verdict came down the wire, a reporter raced to 520 East Superior Street to talk to the woman at the center of it all. He found her alone. Tom had taken the children for a walk. She was, as she had no choice but to be, lying in bed in the front room, her silver-banded watch still hanging loosely on her wrist. As the reporter excitedly told her that a verdict had been given 5 days early, Catherine blinked in surprise.
"I never dreamed of the decision this soon," she croaked with great effort.
The good news spilled from the journalist's lips, a secret he could not wait to share. Yet Catherine was so ill, she showed little emotion at her victory, and did not smile. Tom would later confide that she cries but rarely smiles. She has forgotten how to laugh. It could have been that she did not quite believe it. She half rose in bed in an effort to look at the compensation decision, which was written out for her, but she did not have the strength to do so fully. She sank back against the pillows, and as the news, too, sank in, her primary thought was for Tom. "Her first words," wrote the eager journalist, "formed a wish that her husband Thomas would quickly hear of the decision."
"I am glad for the sake of my children and my husband," Catherine whispered. "The lump sums will help Tom, who has been out of work for many months."
As though remembering, she then said, with a weak smile to the reporter,
"This is the second good news we had in a week. My husband just got back on the payroll at the glass factory."
Some workers had been recalled to Libby Owens, and Tom had managed to get on the night shift. As the reporter lingered in the room, hoping for more copy, Catherine spoke on.
"The judge is grand," she commented. "He's so wonderful. He's very fair. That means a lot."
As though the idea of fairness had triggered something in her, an anger blazed within her for a brief moment.
"It should have been done a long time ago," she said, almost bitterly. "I've been suffering. I'll have to suffer more."
She went on,
"I wonder if I will live to receive any of the money. I hope so, but I am afraid it will come too late."
Yet Catherine had not put her life at risk for herself. She had done it for her family and friends.
"Now maybe Tom and our two children can really live again," she said in hope. "I may not live to enjoy the money myself, but I hope it will come in time for the other girls. I hope they get it before their conditions become as bad as mine."
She added one final comment, a croaked whisper that fell flat in the oddly quiet, stale-aired room, which held none of the jubilation of the courtroom in Chicago.
"I hope the lawyers don't upset it," Catherine Donahue said.
55. 2 weeks after the judgment, Radium Dial filed an appeal against the verdict, upon contention the award was contrary to the evidence. Having anticipated such a move, Grossman and the Society of the Living Dead instantly staged a media photo call and launched an appeal for immediate funds for Catherine. She has no money, no prospects of getting any through her own efforts, and mounting doctor's bills, declared Charlotte Purcell. I fear Mrs. Donahue will die before her case is adjudicated. Catherine was touched by her friend's support, but her overwhelming concern was for Tom. He had taken the news of the appeal hard. He doesn't say much, Catherine confided to Pearl, but it has been such a strain on him. The women continued to enlist the help of the media in their campaign for justice. The Donahues invited the Toronto Star into their home for an interview. The eggshell woman in the bed may be dying, wrote Star journalist Frederick Griffin, but she is fighting. They were all fighting, the women and their supporters, too. As Griffin visited 520 East Superior Street one quiet April evening, he met all the dial painters who had filed suit, as well as the men standing behind them, Inez's father George, Tom, Al, Clarence, and Hobart. This senseless tragedy had affected them as well as their wives and daughters. They're scared, Clarence Witt said of the women, as his wife readied Catherine in the other room. Every little ache or pain scares them. It was now more than 2 months since Catherine had battled to give her evidence from her sickbed. The intervening weeks had wrought havoc with her body. I looked at the shrunken face, arms, form, the shapeless jaw and mouth, Griffin remembered as he entered her makeshift bedroom. A glance at her skeleton outline beneath the coverlet makes you wonder if she will see the week out. Yet, as Catherine fluttered open her eyes and fixed them on the reporter, he realized that she had more grit in her than he'd thought. Mrs. Donahue, this remnant of a woman, took on her role as president of this strange society, he later wrote. She lay motionless, but she was businesslike. Please publish this, she said candidly. I want you, when you write about us, to put in a good word for our lawyer, Mr. Grossman. She was commanding. Her voice at this meeting, Griffin said, was brisk and strong. Grossman had paid for the entire legal proceedings himself, including the continuing expenses of the appeal, and Catherine wanted to be sure he would be rewarded with publicity, at least. You hear the voice of the Society of the Living Dead, Grossman himself now intoned. That is the voice of the ghost women speaking not only here in this room, but to the world. This voice is going to strike the shackles off the industrial slaves of America. You girls have rights to better laws. That's what the society is going to work for. Griffin interviewed them all. Each woman had her own heart-rending story. I'd hate to tell you how I feel now, Marie sighed. My ankles and jaw pain me all the time. I don't know what day is going to be my last, said Olive anxiously. I lie at night staring at the ceiling and thinking maybe it's my last on earth. It is an effort to do things in the ordinary way, to act normally, confessed Pearl. I don't show it, but at present I am nervous and shaking. What I have lost, I can never recover. I am missing so much, she almost cried out. The chance of being a mother again. I can never be the mother and wife that my fine husband deserves. As for Catherine, she suddenly burst out with just 3 words. All are gone. Perhaps, like Catherine Sharb, she had a chorus of ghost girls playing in her head. Ella, and Peg, and Mary, and Inez. The words, remarked Griffin, came unexpectedly and strong. There was silence again. For Tom Donahue, listening in, it was too much. He spoke up bitterly, his voice quivering. We've got humane societies for dogs and cats, but they won't do anything for human beings," he spat out. "These women have souls." Griffin asked one final question before he took his leave. "How do you keep up your morale?" It was Catherine who answered, unexpectedly, with startling effect and strength. She said, "By our faith in God." But though Catherine's faith was as strong as it had ever been, as the days went by, her body weakened. Just a week or so later, she wrote to Pearl. "Tried to write sooner, but somehow I can't write any more. It is so difficult for me to get up for any length of time, and when I do, I'm all in for a week afterwards." The continuing legal trouble was not helping her. "I only wish my case was through with," she said wistfully. "Lord knows I need the medical care, and need it badly." Though her friends tried to rally round her, Olive brought fruit and a pail of fresh eggs, and Pearl even bought her a new nightgown from the meager funds she and Hobart had to spare, Catherine's body refused to respond to their comforting gestures. She suffered excruciating, constant pain that required the continuous administration of narcotics. Her jawbone continued to fracture into ever smaller fragments, each new break more painful than the last, and with the new breaks came a new development. Catherine started hemorrhaging from her jaw. She lost approximately 1 pint of blood each time. Though she wanted to stay at home with Tom, her physician, Dr. Dunn, rushed her to hospital, what Catherine called a hurried-up trip. "I want to be home," she wrote forlornly to Pearl from her hospital bed. "Am so lonesome. Doctor wants me here. Tom wants a nurse at home. I just don't know what to do. I suffer so much pain." She begged Pearl to visit her. "Come over, if possible, won't you, as soon as you get this letter? I'm so lonesome and blue." Dr. Dunn was increasingly concerned for Catherine. Though he kept her in the hospital for several weeks, her condition was terminal. She was so weak that he thought the slightest labor could be lethal. He issued a formal statement, "In my opinion, any unusual stress, such as a court appearance, might prove fatal. I have advised and urged her to forego any such activity." But this was Catherine Donahue he was talking about. No matter what her doctor said, she was determined to fight radium dial tooth and nail. The company was not going to get away with it this time. Released from hospital by the start of June 1938, she was home just in time to hold a meeting at her house the day before the appeal hearing. Grossman and the other women were there. "There's not much hope for me now," Catherine said to them, acknowledging it. "I only have to wait a while. It will help you girls to win, and it will help my children." "Her children and Tom," she said, "are worth all the pain and suffering." Dr. Loeffler visited the same day. Her thin body barely dented the mattress as he took her blood, drawing it from arms scarcely thicker than fingers. Catherine was so weak these days she did not wear her glasses anymore, but the watch Tom had given her still encircled her wrist, on the tightest fastening they could find. Whereas once she had dressed smartly in her polka-dot dress for such gatherings, now she wore a starched white cotton nightgown, embroidered with two crucifixes on the pointed collar. When Dr. Loeffler weighed her, Catherine knew at once that he would not overrule the veto Dunn had put on her attending tomorrow's hearing. Catherine Donahue now weighed 61 pounds. She was not much heavier than her 5-year-old son. In truth, Even if she had been well enough to attend, it would have been almost impossible for them to transport her. She could not bear the slightest pressure on her body any more. Although Catherine was unable to attend the appeal hearing, she trusted Grossman implicitly to represent her interests. "He is just about the best there is, isn't he?" she said of him. And Grossman was not alone in standing up for her. Pearl, Charlotte, Marie, Olive, and the other women were there. And so was Tom Donahue. The hearing was held before a capacity crowd on a Monday afternoon. Having seen Catherine's condition the day before, Grossman now declared the case was a race with death. "If Mrs. Donahue dies before a final ruling," he said solemnly, "her estate, under the law, would receive nothing." Perhaps that was why Madgett immediately requested a postponement, but it was not granted. Presumably on Catherine's request, Grossman suggested that a bedside hearing be held so she could be present, but this was vigorously contested by the firm. In the end, the judge determined that he would hear the appeal evidence that very afternoon. The gathered media were speculative about what grounds Radium Dial might have for an appeal. One of the company's arguments was that the IIC was without jurisdiction, but this was immediately dismissed. Another was the statute of limitations, again, and a third argument was something completely different. For Radium Dial now contested the girls' claims altogether. The firm alleged they were lying. As sworn evidence, Radium Dial submitted to the court a formal statement from one Mr. Reed, the girls' former boss. In it, Reed swore, "He never told anyone, nor ever heard anyone tell, Catherine Donahue or other employees, radium wouldn't hurt them." He also swore, "He was not on the company payroll during the time Catherine was exposed to radium." His wife, Mercedes Reed, also submitted a signed stipulation. Both she and her husband said they would testify that neither of them gave, nor did anyone else in their hearing give, any orders or instructions to Catherine Donahue to insert in her mouth the brushes used. The girls were stunned. The Reeds were the ones who were lying. Why, you only had to look up their name in the town directory through all the years Catherine was employed there to find Mr. Reed's name next to that of Radium Dial. The company and the man were synonymous. How could he claim he was not working there? And as for swearing that nobody told the girls radium wouldn't hurt them, unfortunately for the company, a full-page ad signed by its president and printed in several editions of the local newspaper asserted exactly that. In response to the Reeds' sworn statements, all the women present that day declared they would testify to the direct opposite. During the hearing, Charlotte and Al Purcell both gave evidence to that effect. Tom Donahue was also on the stand, but this quiet man appears to have been overcome by the occasion. No doubt he was also handicapped by worry for his wife. He stumbled in his testimony, his voice being scarcely audible, and so the commissioner ruled out almost all of his testimony. The so-called evidence of the Reeds was the sole item submitted by the company in its appeal. And so, at 3:30 p.m., the hearing was closed. A five-man committee would judge the final verdict. They promised a decision by July 10th. Catherine just needed to hang on a little bit longer. 56. In America, religion is king, and in 1938 there was an heir apparent, Father Keene of Chicago. He ran the Sorrowful Mother Novena, a weekly church service attended by more than 200,000 people countrywide, to which worshipers submitted personal requests for aid. Keane prayed publicly for them, in church, on the radio, and in a weekly booklet, which was published nationwide so that Catholics across the states could pray for those in need. The novena was a cultural phenomenon. Catherine didn't have the energy to read anymore, depending instead on Tom, so she probably didn't read those published prayers. But Pearl Payne's sister-in-law did. "I would suggest all of your girls write to Father Keane," she encouraged. "I am sure all of you will benefit greatly, and miracles do happen even in this day and age, Pearl, so don't give up hope." Catherine had nothing to lose. During every moment she spent with Mary Jane and Tommy, she felt like her heart was breaking. She needed more time. She needed so much more time with them. And so, at the direction of her dear friend Pearl, on June 22, 1938, Catherine summoned all her courage and her faith, and she wrote from the bottom of her heart, "Dear Father Keane, the doctors tell me I will die, but I mustn't. I have too much to live for, a husband who loves me and two children I adore. But, the doctors say, radium poisoning is eating away my bones and shrinking my flesh to the point where medical science has given me up as one of the living dead. They say there is nothing that can save me, nothing but a miracle. And that's what I want, a miracle. But if that is not God's will, perhaps your prayers will obtain for me the blessing of a happy death. Please. Mrs. Catherine Wolfe Donahue." That "please" said it all. Catherine was begging for help. She had no shame or pride now. She just wanted to survive. Just 1 month longer. Just one more week. One more day. Such was her fame as the leader of her Living Dead Society. Her letter made front-page news. The reaction to her note was extraordinary, even by the standards of the popular novena. There was a sweeping response, the length and breadth of the land. Prayers were said daily for Catherine throughout the nation. Hundreds of thousands of people queued in the rain to pray for her. Catherine herself received almost 2,000 letters. "I would like to answer them all," she said, quite overwhelmed, "but of course I can't." And even though one has to take the news reports with a pinch of salt, it worked. By the following Sunday, Catherine was sitting up and eating her first meal with her family in months. "Doctors told me today," Leonard Grossman announced on July 3rd, "they don't know what is keeping her alive. It is fortunate indeed that Catherine finds comfort in prayer. It is fortunate that she is a Christian and may forgive. She can never forget." Catherine counted each day as it passed. July 10th was not so very far away. She was living for her children, for Tom, but also for justice. She simply prayed it would be done. And on July 6th, 1938, 4 days early, her prayers were answered. On this date, the appeal of the Radium Dial Company was thrown out of court by the IIC. They upheld Catherine's award, and not only that, they added an additional $730, $12,271, to it, to cover the medical expenses she had incurred since April. It was a unanimous decision from all 5 members of the adjudicating panel. "It was," Catherine wrote with exultant pleasure, "a wonderful victory." "I'm so happy for Catherine," Pearl wrote excitedly to Grossman after she heard the good news. "I sincerely hope she benefits at once, so she may enjoy some medical comforts and things she actually wishes for." Yet, the one thing Catherine truly wished for, the return of her health, seemed, despite all her prayers, to be out of her reach. In the middle of July, she had a bad spell and had to have the doctor. But Catherine Donahue was not done fighting yet. When Olive stopped in to see her a day later, she found Tom asleep from his night shift, but Catherine sitting up, eating her lunch, wearing the pretty nightgown Pearl had given her. "She did look nice in it," commented Olive fondly. "Poor child, my heart goes out to her." Catherine was doing so well that on July 17th, the women decided to have a reunion to celebrate their success. They had a lovely time talking about their incredible victory. The other girls were full of plans for their own cases. Thanks to Catherine's triumph in court, they, too, could now bring claims before the IIC. Grossman said he would begin litigating Charlotte's case immediately. The others were having medical examinations in Chicago to support their claims. Pearl began consulting Dr. Dalich. "Personally," she wrote to him, "I think it was an act of God that sent you to Ottawa in Catherine Donahue's case." Pearl felt an unfamiliar sensation these days. She realized, with some surprise, it was a pleasant anticipation for the future. "I live," she said, simply, "in the hope of living." Catherine did the same. Yet it was not a smooth life. On Friday, July 22nd, Tom was so worried about her that he called out Father Griffin to administer last rites. Catherine, lying weakly in bed, wistfully asked her husband, "Is it that bad?" Though Tom was unable to answer, in fact, it wasn't that bad. Catherine lived on and on, day after day, the verdict in court seeming to buoy her. It gave her another hour, another dawn, one more day in which she could greet Tom in the morning, kiss Mary Jane goodnight, see Tommy draw just one more picture with his watercolor paints. Catherine kept on living. And then, on July 26th, Radium Dial went above the IIC to file another appeal in the circuit court. They alleged the commission did not take into proper consideration the firm's judicial propositions. It was a shock, a stab to the happy balloon of hope that Catherine had been carrying. It was a blow from which she found she simply could not recover. She had held on, Grossman said, to a slim thread of life as long as she could. But yesterday's move to deprive her of what was legally hers was too much. She had to let go. Catherine Wolfe Donahue died at 2:52 a.m. on Wednesday, July 27th, 1938, the day after Radium Dial filed its latest appeal. She passed away at home on East Superior Street. Tom and the children were by her side. She remained conscious until a short time before her death, and then just slipped away. Those who were with her to the end agreed she died a peaceful death. She weighed less than 60 pounds. As was tradition, her family kept her at home with them. They washed and dressed her in a pretty pink gown, looped her precious rosary beads through her still fingers. Her plain gray coffin was an open one, lined with ivory silk and covered with a veil. And as she lay there, she did, indeed, look truly peaceful and at rest. Her casket was surrounded by garlands and tall candles, lending light against the darkness as she spent her final few nights in the place she had called home. Now, the neighbors came. Some of them had shunned her before, but now they came to help. All day long, Eleanor, the housekeeper, took in offers of aid and dishes of food. "Everyone has been very kind," she said, perhaps a little tightly. Some of that kindness would have gone further when Catherine was still alive. Catherine's friends came, too. They brought flowers. They brought their love and grief. Pearl came dressed in the same outfit she had worn when she and Catherine had gone to Chicago, on that long-ago summer day when they'd persuaded Grossman to take their case. Perhaps it was a symbolic choice, chosen for happier times. Yet it did not work. As Pearl knelt by her friend's coffin to pray for her, she was almost hysterical at her loss. Tom was strangely stoic, though his head was bowed and his cheeks sunken. Observers said his spirit seemed broken, but he had to carry on for the children. He dressed respectfully for Catherine in a black suit and tie, but his shoes were scuffed and unpolished, perhaps the sort of detail to which his wife had once attended. He and Eleanor got the children ready for their day, tying a ribbon in Mary Jane's hair and slicking down Tommy's. It did not work. Bits of it kept sticking up. Tom paid his best attention to them, letting Mary Jane fiddle with the unfamiliar suit jacket on her father's shoulders, giving Tommy a hug as his son shyly looped an arm around his father's neck. The children stood before their mother's casket, but they did not understand. They spoke to her and wondered why she did not reply. "Why doesn't Mommy talk?" asked Mary Jane innocently. Tom could not, he just could not answer. He tried, but his words were choked back by tears. He led the children silently away. That first evening without Catherine, nuns from the St. Columba Parish School she had attended came to say the rosary by her side. They chanted the prayers, a song of loss and lamentation as they sent her soul on its way. They were still there as the children went through their first nightly routine without their mother and knelt to say their own prayers. Mary Jane, aged just 3, said hers in a tiny piping voice that carried through the quiet house. As her mother lay downstairs, perhaps to her young mind merely sleeping, Mary Jane prayed as she had always learned to do. "God bless Mommy and Daddy." The night before Catherine's funeral, as necessitated by Illinois law in cases of poisoning, an inquest was held into her death. Tom and Catherine's friends attended. Grossman was there, too. He branded her death a cool, calculating, money-making murder. As dramatic as Grossman's declaration was, it was Tom's testimony which was most powerful, due to his raw emotion. The inquest was held the day after Catherine died. He was described as a weary little man with gray hair, shaken with grief. But no matter how shaken he was, he had to testify at the inquest. He spoke with great difficulty and choked up when he described his wife's death, said a witness. His breathing became greatly labored, and further questioning was cut short. He left the stand in tears. The jury of 6 men stayed silent throughout, as not only Tom, but also Dr. Dunn and Dr. Loeffler gave evidence. The jury was instructed by the coroner that they had only to find the cause of death and that it was not their province to fix the responsibility for Mrs. Donahue's demise. But they did anyway. We, the jury, find that Catherine Donahue died of radium poisoning absorbed while she was employed in an industrial plant in Ottawa. At Grossman's suggestion, the name of the radium dial company was added to the formal verdict. It's the only industrial plant Mrs. Donahue ever worked in, he said sharply. With the jury's verdict in, Catherine's death certificate was formally signed. Was death in any way related to occupation of deceased? Yes. Catherine Wolfe Donahue was buried on Friday, July 29, 1938. Her children were not old enough to attend the funeral, but hundreds of people gathered to pay their respects to this most exceptional woman, a quiet, unassuming person who had only wanted to work hard and love her family, but who made a difference to millions in the way she responded to her own personal tragedy. She was carried from her home by an assorted mix of Wolfe and Donahue relatives, this final journey at last causing her no more pain. Her friends lined the street outside her home to accompany her to church. Only Charlotte Purcell was missing, quarantined in Chicago, caring for her children, who had caught scarlet fever. The women wore their best clothes, not black attire, but floral dresses and colored gowns. They dipped their heads as Catherine's coffin was carried past. And then they followed her, past Division Street and on to Columbus, where the slow cortege turned left. They followed her all the way to St. Columba, which had always been her spiritual home, the place where she had been baptized, where she had married Tom, and where, now, she took her final bow. She had not been back since she fell ill. But on this funeral day, Catherine Donahue, once again, made her slow way down the aisle of the church and rested once more in the grace of God beneath that towering, arched ceiling that had been so familiar to her in life, bathed in the colored light from the stained glass windows that her husband's family had helped to buy. Father Griffin led the Mass. He spoke of the relief that death made for Mrs. Donahue after her long and patient sufferings. It seemed, to Tom, too short a service, for when it was over, all that was left was the burial. The burial, and then the rest of his life to live without her. He was near collapse as he bade farewell to his wife. The other mourners joined him in his helpless grief. In a silent but impressive few moments, a witness wrote, Catherine's best friends, the girls who worked in the plant with her and contracted the same poisoning, said goodbye. The scene brought to mind the words of the ancient gladiators of glorious Rome, Moritamus te salut mamus. We who are about to die salute thee. Their heads and their hearts were filled with Catherine, filled with her even as they left the church and blocked out the sight of the old high school across the road, where she had been poisoned. Their hearts stayed full of her, as Pearl wrote to Grossman later that same day. When I returned home from Catherine Donahue's funeral with my heart full of her, and thoughts of your great work at the inquest and the circuit court, I felt I must drop this little note and let you know my heart is filled with gratitude when I think of the courageous battle you are waging on behalf of us girls. She closed with prayers and best wishes for further successes. For even on the day of Catherine's funeral, Grossman was in court defending her claim. The company had been denied the right of appeal, but they were appealing even that. They appealed over and over and over. In fact, Radium Dial fought the case all the way to the Supreme Court of the United States of America. Other lawyers might have dropped the case, citing lack of funds, for Grossman was still covering the expenses. But Leonard Grossman had vowed to stand by the women, and he did not let them down. He just collapsed after overworking on this case, his wife, Trudel, said. Perhaps Radium Dial were hoping either he or the girls would give up the fight, maybe run out of money. But they were battling in Catherine's memory now, and that was a powerful motivator. Grossman had to get a special license to be admitted to the Supreme Court. That license was under glass in our house forever, said his son. He talked about the case. He was proud of it, and the scrapbooks were always in the middle of the bookshelf. I heard some of the stories over and over again. I grew up with this case. When the case went to the Supreme Court, he went on, my parents both went to Washington for it. I looked it up. Cert denied. The court decided not to hear it. It meant they were upholding the lower court. Catherine Wolfe Donahue had won her case. She won it 8 times in total, but the final victory came on October 23, 1939. The papers described her battle for justice as one of the most spectacular fights against industrial occupational hazards. Now that battle was at an end, finally at an end. It was a pure, clean victory, with no clouds or contingencies to sully it. No settlement. No board of doctors to poke and prod and say that there was no such thing as radium poisoning. No firm reneging on an out-of-court agreement that had been made in good faith. Now there were no more legal machinations, no lawyers twisting words, no law itself whose unclear wording tied mercy up in knots. It was outright justice, plain and true. The women had been vindicated. The Dial painters had won. And it was Catherine Wolfe Donahue, in the end, who had led them to victory. If there are saints on earth, one commentator said, and you believe in that, I think Catherine Wolfe Donahue was one of them. I really do. She was buried in St. Columba Cemetery. She had a simple, flat gravestone, as unobtrusive and as neat and tidy as she herself had been in life. Epilogue. The Radium Girls did not die in vain. Although the women could not save themselves from the poison that riddled their bones, in countless ways their sacrifice saved many thousands of others. 50 days before the final triumph in Catherine Donahue's case, war was declared in Europe. It meant that there was, once again, an enormous demand for luminous dials to light the dashboards of military machines and the wristwatches of soldiers taking up arms. Yet, thanks to Catherine and Grace and their colleagues' bravery in speaking out about what had happened to them, dial painting was now the most feared occupation among young women. No longer could the government sit idly by. The Radium Girls' demise demanded a response. Safety standards were introduced that protected a whole new generation of dial painters, based entirely on knowledge gained from the bodies of those women who had come before. The standards were set not a moment too soon, for 7 months later, America formally entered the war. The U.S. radium dial painting industry exploded, with USRC alone increasing its personnel by 1,600%. Radium dials were even bigger business than the first time round, The United States used more than 190 grams of radium for luminous dials during the Second World War. In contrast, fewer than 30 grams were used worldwide in the earlier conflict. In addition, a chemist called Glenn Seaborg, who was employed on the most secret mission of them all, the Manhattan Project, wrote in his diary, "As I was making the rounds of the laboratory rooms this morning, I was suddenly struck by a disturbing vision of the workers in the radium dial painting industry. Atomic bomb making involved widespread use of radioactive plutonium, and he realized at once that similar hazards faced those working on the project. Seaborg insisted that research be undertaken into plutonium. It was found to be biomedically very similar to radium, meaning it would settle into the bones of anyone exposed to it. The Manhattan Project issued non-negotiable safety guidelines to its workers, based directly on the radium safety standards. Seaborg was determined that the women's ghosts would not be joined by those of his colleagues who were working to win the war. After the Allies had triumphed, helped by the deployment of those very atomic bombs that the Manhattan Project built, the debt the country owed to the Radium Girls was acknowledged in full. An official of the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission, AEC, wrote, "If it hadn't been for those dial painters, the Manhattan Project's management could have reasonably rejected the extreme precautions that were urged on it, and thousands of workers might well have been, and might still be, in great danger." The women had been, officials said, invaluable. Even after the war was over, the dial painter's legacy continued to save lives as the world entered the age of atomic energy. "We were going to live in an era of plutonium," enthused one man who grew up in 1950s America. "We'd have plutonium cars, planes, it was infinite." The large-scale production of radioactive materials seemed inevitable. "In the foreseeable future," wrote the Consumers League, "millions of workers may be affected by ionizing radiations." The League was right. Almost immediately, however, it became clear that it was not just employees in the new atomic industries who were at risk. The whole planet was. Less than 5 years after the Second World War ended, the nuclear arms race began. Over the next decade, hundreds of above-ground atomic tests were conducted across the globe. Each blast, sending mushroom cloud bomb debris into the sky, eventually resulted in radioactive fallout drifting back to Earth. It landed not only on the test site, but rained down upon fields of green grass, wheat, and cereal, through which the radioactive isotopes in the fallout entered the human food chain. Just as radium had done in the dial painters, these isotopes, especially a particularly dangerous, newly created one called strontium-90, began to deposit in human bones. "Every one of us," wrote the Consumers League in alarm, "is a potential victim." The AEC dismissed the concerns. The risks, it said, were very small when compared to the terrible future we might face if we fell behind in our nuclear defense effort. Yet its words were not sufficient to calm the troubled public. After all, the radium dial painter's agony had alerted the world to the hazards of internal radiation. "They serve as a warning," railed the Consumers League, "of the results of carelessness and ignorance, a cloud on the horizon, no larger than a man's hand." In 1956, growing public unease led the AEC to establish a committee to examine the long-term health risks of atomic tests, specifically the effects of strontium-90. But how, the researchers thought, could they possibly begin this study for the future health of humanity when they were dealing with such an unknown substance? All they really knew was that strontium-90 was chemically similar to radium. There is only a limited pool of people that have had exposure to internal radiation, a radioactivity specialist said. If anything happens in our up-and-coming nuclear age, these people are about the only starting point that anyone has. The dial painters were needed to help once more. They seemed Cassandra-like in their powers, able to predict for scientists the likely long-term health effects of this new radioactive danger. Something that happened far in the past, an AEC official said, is going to give us a look far into the future. He termed the women of incalculable value. Their suffering would provide vital insight with implications for hundreds of millions of people all over the world. In a spookily prophetic letter, Pearl Payne had once written, "My history is unusual and may be of interest to medical men of the future." She could never have anticipated just how right she was. Medical studies began immediately, including in New Jersey and Illinois. Later, the research would be amalgamated into the Center for Human Radiobiology, CHR, which was located in a multi-million dollar clinic called the Argonne National Laboratory, based 75 miles from Ottawa. Here, special lead-lined vaults were constructed, buried under 3 feet of concrete and 10 feet of earth, in which the dial painters' body burdens, the amount of radium inside them, were measured. The research was designed to help future generations and called essential to the security of the nation. "If we can determine the long-term effects of radium," one of the scientists said, "we are quite sure we can predict the long-term low-level effects of fallout." Scientists were seeking to give the world an exact guide on safe radioactivity by studying all dial painters who can be found. There were dial painters still living, albeit with a time bomb ticking in their bones. Dr. Martland had already explained why they had survived thus far. Radium was known to settle in the girls' bones and known to cause late-onset sarcomas, but when such deadly tumors might begin to grow was the factor that remained mysterious, like a dark trick. Radium had not given away all its secrets just yet. The hunt to find those living dial painters now began in earnest. "Wanted, radium workers of the Roaring Twenties," read the headlines. Employment records were procured, and snapshots of those long-ago USRC picnics unearthed. The company photograph taken on the steps of Radium Dial became a vital source of clues. The scientists pronounced, "Each of these persons is worth her weight in gold to science." The girls were termed a reservoir of scientific information. In an eerie echo of the women's treatment when they sued their former firms, private investigators were hired to track them down. Those they found, they often found willing. "She said she would be very happy to do it. Anything for science," a memo recorded. Those dial painters who were still working for USRC participated anonymously for fear of jeopardizing their jobs. There were some who didn't want to stir things up. "Miss Anna Callahan does not know she has radium poisoning, and her family does not want her to know," read one note. Another woman was reluctant to be measured for radium as the scientists couldn't do anything about it anyway. Even family members of the girls took part. Grace Fryer's little brother Art was one. They tested him because he spent so much time with her, and basically she was radioactive, said his son.
I guess the government was trying to figure out if he was going to suffer any ill effects. Though Art was fine, it was a concern that was not exaggerated. Swen Kerr's notes minuted the death of a dial painter's sister. She had reportedly died from radiation exposure, but had never worked at the USRC plant. The source of contamination appears to have been her sister, the dial painter, with whom she shared a bed. Many of the original girls, of course, were no longer alive to help with the study. Edna Hussman had died on March 30, 1939. She was said to have maintained her good spirits and courage until the last. She died of a sarcoma of the femur, leaving her husband, Louis, a widower at the age of 40. Albina Larice, too, had passed away. She died aged 51 on November 18, 1946, also of a leg sarcoma. Pictures of her toward the end show her smiling, with no tension in her face. She passed away 14 days before she and James would have celebrated their 25th wedding anniversary. Yet even the deceased dial painters had something to offer the scientists. Dr. Martland had collected tissue and bone samples from the radium girls when he was making his groundbreaking discoveries in the 1920s, and these ended up in the study's archives. Those contributing to the world's knowledge of radiation included Sarah Mileffer, Ella Eckert, Irene Laporte, and many more. The researchers even went to the Cook County Hospital and brought back Charlotte Purcell's amputated arm. They found it still in its formaldehyde crypt, saved through the decades due to its never-before-seen symptoms. In 1963, perhaps at least partly in response to the research on the dial painters, President Kennedy signed the International Limited Test Ban Treaty, which prohibited atomic tests above ground, underwater, and in outer space. Strontium-90, it had been determined, was too dangerous for humanity after all. The ban undoubtedly saved lives and, very possibly, the entire human race. Atomic energy remained part of the world. It is a part of our lives even today, when 56 countries operate 240 nuclear reactors, and more still are used to power nuclear ships and submarines. Yet thanks to the radium girls, whose experiences led directly to the regulation of radioactive industries, atomic power is able to be operated, on the whole, in safety. The study of the dial painters did not end when the threat of nuclear war subsided. A leading figure in the research, Robley Evans, forcefully argued that it was prudent, and indeed a moral obligation to future generations, to learn as much as possible about the effects of radiation. The AEC agreed, and so, through the Center for Human Radiobiology, the dial painters were studied for their full lifespans. Decade after decade, the radium girls came to CHR to be tested. They agreed to have bone marrow biopsies, blood tests, x-rays, physical exams. The women were asked to fast before coming and to wear clothes that they could easily slip in and out of. They were given probing questions about their mental and physical health. They had breath tests and, of course, they had their body burdens measured in the claustrophobic iron rooms beneath the earth. Even after death, some were autopsied, their bodies giving up secrets that the scientists couldn't learn in life. Thousands of women helped with the study, through their 40s, 50s, 60s, and beyond. Their contribution to medical science is incalculable. We all benefit from their sacrifice and courage every day of our lives.
And among those women who submitted to examination for the good of humanity were some familiar faces. Pearl Payne was one of them. "I believe I was fortunate," she once said of her survival, "in the fact that my radium did not become localized in some of the bones of the body which cannot be removed, as is the case with many of the girls that are dead." Instead of death, Pearl embraced life. She made curtains and dresses on her sewing machine, and